word which we seek to define is life. It's, of course, well known, and its meaning is deceptively obvious. Life is the state of animated being. Life is the vitality and functionality of an organism, as opposed to a dead body, inert chemical matter. And no one can argue with this generic definition. But unfortunately, if we leave the matter here, we must stand aside from some of the most critical and cruel ethical decisions which confront us. If life is simply the state of animation in being, then an embryo is alive, almost from the very moment of its conception. And since we are among those who believe that the commandment must be abided, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not take a life, we are placed in the position of affirming that anyone who interferes with the birth of that embryo takes a life, interferes sinfully and wrongfully the life cycle of man. And if life is simply the state of animation in being, then as long as the heart pumps and the lungs breathe oxygen in and out, so long is the body alive. So long must the physician use every art at his disposal to prolong and to protract being. Whatever be the disintegration of that body, whatever be its deterioration, whatever be the suffering that person is undergoing, as long as there is simple motion, as long as there is that conditioned organic reflex, so long must we exert our every effort to help that being to survive. Life is the state of animation in being. Human life, I submit, is something more than motion, than the pulse beat, than the bellowing in and out and the pumping of air through the lungs. And it is to understand what that plus is, what that definition of human life may be, that I would ask you to think through with me this problem this morning. We are brought to it, of course, by the biological revolution of our day. Such is the sophisticated state of our medical art that we can no longer avoid the critical problems. Has a parent a right to terminate the birth of an unwanted child? Has a patient the right to ask for a quick and easy death and to insist that his body may not become a painful battleground between the microbes of the disease and the medicines of the healer, who in this case cannot heal? We'll return to these questions in a moment. For the moment, allow me to restate Judaism's basic affirmations as regards life, individual life, and the preservation of life. Life is the gracious gift of a kind God. We are born, we exist, we die according to God's will and according to God's wisdom, not according to our own. Once we have received this gift of life, our duty is to prolong it, to be healthy with it, to use it beneficially, to care for it carefully, to husband its strength, so that we may be of service to ourselves and to our fellow men. No man has a right to take another's life, nor even to take his own, unless, of course, the actions of another put his life in jeopardy. Human life is sacred, sacred above all other things on this earth, and it must be kept inviolate. It cannot be handed over to the state or to a bureau or into the control of any other human agency. Now, these moral positions seem self-evident when we state them today. But when they were first promulgated by our peoples 3,000 and more years ago, they marked a watershed in the development of human thought. Until the Bible came along and insisted on the sacredness of human life, society took human life cheaply and looked on the individual human being purely in terms of his function. How useful was he to the society of which he was a part? Babies who were sickly or weak were taken out and exposed on the hillside to die. As Plutarch says of the Spartans, they affirmed that if the child was weak or deformed, his life was disadvantageous both to himself and to the state. What was true of the infirm among the youth was true of the infirm among the aged. The Aegean island of Kos, annually, those who were approaching senility, those who could no longer be useful as pack horses and work animals, were garlanded, dressed in festive togas, brought to a feast, and made to drink from the cup of hemlock. What was true on this Aegean island was true in many primitive civilizations. When a man could no longer produce, when he could no longer bear arms, when he could no longer work in the field, when he could no longer be useful in his craft, he was turned out, driven off into the desert, cast out into the wilderness, allowed to starve, to weaken, and to die. Life in ancient times was brief, and it was brutal. And life in ancient times was lived in and among slaves and peons. Man was not the master of his own fate in the economic or the social realm. And in most ancient law codes, if one maimed his slave or even killed him, he could be accused of negligence against his property, but of no higher crime. Only in our Jewish tradition was the maiming of a slave, the taking of a life, however mean in this level of society, act against the law of God, murder, a capital crime. Judaism affirmed the essential divinity that is within every individual man. However low his caste or his estate, there burns within him a spark of the divine flame. And he who extinguishes that spark defaces the image of God. Here lies the fundament of all democracy. Here lies the opposition to all tyranny. Now, these teachings are old and they are familiar to you. We are blessed by being the heirs of humane tradition. But let us not delude ourselves that because they have been stated and restated time and time again over the centuries, the battle has been won. They are the affirmed possession of all mankind. Nothing could be further from the case. In how many nations of the world today, in 1966, are people handled and mishandled with brutality to suit the needs of the state? Are men looked on simply as a cipher in the labor force, moved hither and there according to the 5-year or the 7-year or the 10-year plan of the community? And who of us can forget the experience of Nazi Germany in the last 30 years? Who of us can forget not alone the crime of genocide against the people which dare to affirm the inviolability of the individual life, the sacredness of man, but the acts of Germany against her own Aryan infirm, against her own Aryan people who were suffering from degenerative diseases, those who had been in a hospital for 5 years and more and who seemingly could not be rehabilitated, were simply exterminated. In Nazi Germany in the 1930s, there was a charitable institution for the hospitalized, and this was a euphemistic cover title for an agency which swept out the weak and the unwanted from hospital and asylum every few months or so and simply liquidated them. 275,000 Aryan Germans were so liquidated during the Nazi regime in the name of efficiency, in the name of the greater overriding needs of the state, out of a concern for the cost of maintaining these people alive, out of a brutal, vulgar lack of concern for human life. Now, to mention the incident of Nazi Germany is to allow us to put it aside. This is madness. We are civilization. But I ask you to remember that whatever Hitler may have been, pathological or no, Hitler's doctors, the cream of the German medical profession, and there was no more highly trained medical profession in the world up to that time, the cream of the Nazi physicians, the cream of the German physicians, went into the concentration camps and experimented on human beings as they might experiment on rats and mice and guinea pigs in their laboratories. And these men were not demented. What allowed them to be contemptuous of human life? I reread recently an article written by Dr. Leo Alexander, a physician who was on the staff of the chief prosecutor at Nuremberg during the war trials for our government. Dr. Alexander went through the massive evidence of Nazi medical brutality, and he sought to understand it, to put it into some meaningful framework. This is his understanding of this tragedy. Even before the Nazis took over, a propaganda barrage was directed against the traditional, compassionate, 19th century attitudes towards the chronically ill for the adoption of a utilitarian, Hegelian point of view. Sterilization and euthanasia of persons with chronic mental illness was discussed at a meeting of Bavarian psychiatrists in 1931. By 1936, extermination of the physically or socially unfit was so openly accepted that its practice was mentioned incidentally in an article published in a German medical journal. State hospitals were required to furnish names of patients who had been ill for 5 years or more and were unable to work. Such persons were generally liquidated by order of the state. Quite apart from the genocide of non-Aryans, 275,000 were put to death in charitable foundations for institutional care. The victims were the mentally defective, psychotics, epileptics, and patients suffering from infirmities of old age, from various organic neurological disorders, such as infantile paralysis, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, and brain tumors. All those unable to work and considered non-rehabilitable were killed. Whatever proportions these crimes assumed, it became evident to all who investigated them that they had started from small beginnings. The beginnings at first were merely a subtle shift of emphasis in the basic attitude of the physicians. It started with the attitude that there is a life not worth the living. The infinitely small wedged-in lever from which this entire trend of mind received its impetus was the attitude towards the non-rehabilitable sick, what Alexander was later to carry out to call the pernicious attitude of an overdone practical realism. The pernicious attitude of an overdone practical realism. Now, what happened in Nazi Germany could happen elsewhere in the world. For I'm afraid that all of us are guilty at times of this pernicious attitude of an overdone practical realism, of putting aside our concern for the sacredness of man, of putting aside our concern for the inviolability of the individual, and of considering only the costs per patient per day, the tax dollar, what is demanded of us, the growing bureaucracy, all the other very practical problems which we are concerned with when we confront human welfare. And I'm afraid that such is the size and the ubiquity of the modern state, that if we put aside our concern for the sacredness of the individual, and we allow a pharaoh or a bureau to take over decisions of life and death, to manage these on the basis of the standard of efficiency, of utility, it will not long be before many of the basic decisions affecting each and every one of our lives is taken over and governed by the outside authority no longer allowed to us. It is for this reason that I prize the unbroken opposition over 2,000 years among the rabbis to any and every act of euthanasia. Judaism never tolerated the taking of a life. Now, this seems as a cruel discipline. What is harder than sitting beside the bed of a loved one, racked with pain, crying out for help, for release, and denying to them that release? And yet I submit that the rabbis, who above all things were gentle and compassionate, bridled and reined in their gentleness and their compassion here because of an overriding concern to keep high the barriers which protect the dignity, the sacredness of human personality. We read in the law code, the Sefer Hasidim, if a man is sick and suffering and dying, and he appeals to his friend to kill him mercifully, that appeal must be turned down, nor has he the right to take his own life. Euthanasia is never countenanced anywhere as in our religious tradition. Not that Judaism ennobles suffering. Suffering can brutalize and ruin a man. No man in Judaism must take the place of God. It is Adonai who may meet to Mahayyeh. It is God who gives life and who takes it away. Who are we to know what are the involvements of the divine wisdom? Why God has chosen this man to linger, this man to die quickly? Why God has chosen this child to be a cripple and this child to be healthy? And each of us here has lived long enough to know that though God's ways are not our ways and are beyond our human understanding, there is often a deeper wisdom which permeates and comes out of it. Have we not seen those who are burdened with a child of limitations, whose marriage is sanctified by the burden, who become adult because of their new responsibility? And have we not seen those who are suffering under the blight of a degenerative disease suddenly come alive to themselves, break down the walls of selfishness, of fear, of shyness, which immured them from the world? Open up, at least for one last instance, to the love and to the friendship, to the excitement and to the beauty that is all about them, which they have denied themselves to this time. Man must not play God to take another's life. It is the prerogative only of the divine. Have we then no other alternative but to stand aside, to watch suffering, not to be helpful, to turn off and to rein in our kindness, our sensitivity, our sense of fellow feeling? Many do stop here. But I wonder if there is not an out, a way in which we can maintain the dignity of human life, and a way in which we can show our compassion. Let me quote you the entirety of the law with which I began. If a man is sick, suffering and dying, and he asks his friend to kill him mercifully, this request must be turned down, nor has he the right to take himself, nor have we the right to place salt on his tongue in order to keep him alive any longer. Now, the prescription is medieval, but the meaning is clear. There is a point at which it is immoral to struggle to preserve a life. There is a point at which we must step aside and allow God to reclaim his own. There is a point at which to struggle to preserve a life is only to struggle to place another man for a longer protracted period of time in a condition of agony and suffering. Our rabbis often commented on the phrase in the book of Ecclesiastes, there's a time to be born there is a time to die. And one of the sermons which was preached on this text reads in this vein. If a friend is deathly ill, pray not over long for his recovery. For if your prayer be efficacious and he revive, he will be conscious only for a few days, and he will know great suffering in that time. Let him die. There is a time to die. Our rabbis believed that prayer was an efficacious physical therapy. Prayer sustained life. And when one prayed for another's life, one actually contributed to his healing. This was their faith. This was their understanding of the psychosomatic involvements of medicine. This was their frustration because of the rudimentary quality of their medical art. Whatever the reason, the rabbis believed that when you prayed for another man's life, you contributed to his longevity and to his healing. And so when they said to us, when they said to their congregations, pray not for the life which has already been lost. Pray not for the man who is deep in the midnight blackness of the coma, that he come out for an hour or two into the grayness of pain. They were saying to us in our terms, there is a time for the physician to pack his bag, to pull out his tube, to remove the mask, to allow death to the dying. There's a very interesting story in the Talmud to this effect. Judah Hanasi was the greatest of the rabbinic leaders in Palestine at the end of the second century. He was not only a scholar and teacher, but he was a prince. He was the governor of the Jewish community. Judah Hanasi, at the end of a long life, lay dying. And his many disciples, his many friends, drew around his house and set up a prayer vigil. They would not allow him to depart. Now, there was in Judah Hanasi's house a very learned handmaiden, a servant, girl, who was much praised in the Talmud, though the Talmud never tells us her name. And when all of these disciples of Judah Hanasi drew near and began their prayer vigil, she prayed for his speedy death. But her lone voice was as nothing against the many voices of those who kept the vigil. And Judah Hanasi lingered on. And so this servant girl went to the roof of the house and brought up to the roof many large earthenware jars, which on a signal she threw down into the midst of those who kept the vigil, and the shattering of the clay, the breaking of the pottery, the explosive noise disturbed their concentration. The startling drove them away. Their vigil broken. Judah Hanasi was allowed to die in peace. Now this strange anecdote, this vignette, is told in the Talmud with approval, because the rabbis agreed with our sensitivity that there is a time beyond which it is an indignity, it is wrong to prolong and to protract the life. But when does that time come? When should the doctor turn aside and allow nature to take his course? There is, I'm afraid, in our medical profession today only confusion unto this point. Some doctors have worked out their own philosophies, and after consultation with the family, take whatever action they deem fit. Other physicians follow a rather straight and narrow application of their Hippocratic oath. This oath requires of them that they be healers. It tells them that their responsibility is to prolong life. And as long as there is life, they insist on using every skill at their disposal, often to morally unacceptable ends. I shall never forget, as a chaplain during the Korean War, being for many days in one of our advanced-based hospitals, watching the soldiers being brought in mutilated from the battlefield. Great miracles of science were wrought in that hospital. But every once in a while, a youth was brought in, the entire forepart of his brain having been blown away. Now, such is the state of our medical skill that the surgeons there could sew up the cavity, place tubes to feed and to eliminate the body within the body, place the body upon a cot which rotated slowly, moving the body fluids sufficiently to sustain life. And this lad was sustained for a week, or a month or several months. Witless, thoughtless, unseeing, unfeeling, a vegetable. Sustained alive, flown back to these United States to a hospital near his home, where his parents or his wife or his children had to keep a bedside vigil, a hapless vigil, until death finally intervened. Now, I am sure that similar miracles are being wrought in Vietnam today, even as I am sure that there are those in our hospitals in this city who are being kept alive deep in a coma, though death has long since announced itself to their soul. There is a time to live, and there is a time to die. But how shall we know when that time has come? Here, interestingly, Hebrew etymology serves us in good stead. Hebrew has a word for life, as animate being. The word is chayim. Chayim applies equally to the amoeba, to the paramecia, as it does to this complicated structure which we call man. But when Hebrew wishes to refer to man uniquely, to that which is human life, it implies the word nefesh, a soul, specifically personality, awareness, the mind which integrates all the senses and allows us to think and to relate and to be part of the world. Human life is a construct higher than life itself. Human life is personality, it is consciousness, it is awareness, and it is in these terms that we must define it. Nor can I be accused of reading back into the second century a subtlety required in the 20th century. In the Mishnah, in that great book of law which Judah Hanasi compiled in the second century, we read already that one may abort an embryo if its birth threatens the life of the mother. Now the question is asked in the second century, on what basis can one take this embryo and destroy it? And the answer is given. The embryo is chayim, is animate, but it does not yet have a nefesh, human life, a soul. A soul comes with birth, with the awareness of the opening of the senses, with the integration of knowledge. An embryo has only chayim. And interestingly, too, the best of modern biological thinking today emphasizes that human life is like life on all other levels of society, except on the level of consciousness, except on the level of awareness. Here alone is human life superior to all other life that courses about us. Chayim and nefesh. If we keep this differentiation in mind, simple life and human life, animation and consciousness, I think we will have a standard by which to make some of the ethical decisions with which we began. How does this definition help us? Well, in the case of the embryo is chayim. It is animate, but not less human. To take the life of the embryo is therefore not an act of murder. It may often be done for good and superior reasons to allow a nefesh, an already adult, conscious human being, to survive. This, of course, is the position of our Mishnah. The rabbis went further, and they said one may abort the birth, not only when the mother's life is at stake, but when there is danger of psychological trauma to the mother. And I would go even further. Whenever the parent feels the child who is about to be born is either endangered by an addiction which she may have, by a disease which she may have suffered, or is endangered by the fact that he will be born into a marriage that is no marriage, into a home that is no home, into a loveless life where he will never have the ability to grow as into a human being, society ought to permit the termination of that conception. What of the child who is newborn? Here, I am afraid our definition restrains us. There may be a few children who are born who are simply masses of protoplasm. But who are we to play God? And to say that the lame and the halt and the blind shall not leave the delivery room? What arrogance is it on the part of a parent when they turn to the doctor sometime before the delivery and say, if the package comes unbroken, we'll accept it. But if not, allow it to be stillborn. What an example of courage our world would have lacked. If an obstetrician had decided before he went into the delivery room that the deaf and the dumb and the blind child should not be allowed to live, we would never have known of Helen Keller. Eugenics is a pernicious and false science. And any attempt to say that there is a physical frame or a mental quotient which a child must have in order to be useful to his society is to impose your own arrogance upon the needs of mankind. How do you measure gentleness? How do you measure love? Have not cripples and the lame and the halt contributed to civilization? Are we to be only the sturdy and the physical? How do you measure the sensitivities of the newborn child? And finally, what of the dying? How does our definition help us here? Euthanasia, never. What do we have, fortunately, the chemical means to give great relief from pain? But we ought never to create an atmosphere or a society or a legal condition which allows one man to take another man's life. Imagine a community in which this existed, in which euthanasia was legal. Imagine the indignity of placing an aged parent under the pressure of children who want to stop pacing up and down the hospital floors and say, Father, Mother, be free of your pain. Allow the doctor to give you an injection. Must a man in his last suffering have the added indignity of feeling himself a coward because he wants to hold on to the one thing he possesses, life, as long as he can? And who knows at what stage of one's deterioration one ceases to contribute mankind. When Heine was first stricken with paralysis and cemented, as he put it, to his mattress grave, he cried out for release. He begged his friends to put him out of his misery, and yet it was on this mattress grave that he wrote his finest and most subtle and profound poetry. He became a great artist and rather than a shallow satirical man. Who knows? Who knows what impact the dying can have on the living, their insight, their truth have, their last words may have on our own lives. But there does come a time when deterioration is so pronounced, when the mind is so disorganized, when the coma is black and full, when we have lost our orientation, when we have lost our ability to relate consciousness, when the nefesh has been reduced to chayim, personality to simple conditioned reflex, the impulsive routine action of the organs done without any command from our will. There is a time when it is time to step aside, to allow God to have his way. What is the meaning of life? Awareness, feeling, sensitivity, being part of the actions and the passions of our day. What is life? Life is consciousness. What is the meaning of death? The meaning of death is the making way, the opening of opportunity to another generation, our last and most important gift to our children. What is death? The mystery, unconsciousness, a state we need not fear. There is a time to be born, and there is a time to die. There's a time when man must struggle to preserve life, for that is his fundamental responsibility. And there is a time to leave off the struggle and allow animation to cease. And so, beside the silent sea, I wait the muffled oar. No harm from him can come to me on ocean or on shore. I know not where his islands lift their fronded palms in air. I only know I cannot drift beyond his love and care. And thou, O Lord, by whom are seen thy creatures as they be, forgive me if too close I lean my human heart to thee. Amen.